Thank you for joining us this morning. My name is Grace Kuipers, and I am a health promotion specialist at PTCC. I will be moderating today's webinar outlining Ontario's progress in tobacco control 2012. If you're having any trouble logging on to the webinar via the Microsoft link, please call the 1-800 number for PTC. The number is 1-800-363-7822. A reminder also that you can access your backup version of our presentation deck that was emailed to you yesterday to follow along with our webinar. And as you may be aware, we are recording this webinar. Please be sure that we will be posting this recorded webinar on our website in approximately a week. For many who are logged into our webinar, you will see the presentation on your right. On your left side of the screen will be a chat box. This chat box is made public to everyone. Whatever you write will be posted and viewable by all those in the webinar, as well as by me and our presenters. During this webinar, we'll be pausing to take questions at predetermined times. Feel free to enter any questions in this box, and we will try to answer as many as possible during the Q&A sessions of the presentation. We will be using the chat box function only for the questions, because there are over 150 people registered, and we decided that to avoid background noise for our recording, it was best to have the lines muted. And of course, because of time constraints, we may not be able to get to all of the questions, but we'll try to answer a good variety today. And now I'd like to welcome our first presenter, Dr. Rob Schwartz. Dr. Rob Schwartz is the Executive Director of the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit and Associate Professor at the Dalla Lana School of Public Health, University of Toronto. He has interest in research, evaluation, and knowledge exchange. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you.
And our second presenter, Dr. Sean O'Connor. He is an expert in the surveillance of tobacco control outcomes at OTRU. Sean leads the Strategy Evaluation Working Group, which produces an annual report detailing progress of the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy, which we're talking about today. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks.
So now I'd like to turn it over to our presenters.
Thank you very much, Grace, and thank you to Francine and Marilyn Pope and Marion Smith from OTRU who have helped organize this webinar. It's really a great pleasure for us to be back, Sean and I, this year. Last year we did our opening annual webinar on the strategy evaluation report, and we hope to continue this for many years to come. The purpose of this discussion today is twofold. It's first to whet your appetites for delving into at least parts of the very long report which has been sent to you and for which you can link if you haven't already on our website, which is www.otru.org. There is a short executive summary also that will give you the main highlights. The second purpose of today's webinar is for us to entertain questions that you may have from reading through parts of the report prior to this presentation or from the points that we raise as we go along. So we will be pausing from time to time and welcoming your questions about the data, about our conclusions, and anything else that comes to mind that may be important for the work that you are all doing in the public health units and in provincial agencies across Ontario to support the Smoke-Free Ontario strategy. We at OTRU have been producing an annual report, used to be called a monitoring report. Now we call it the Strategy Evaluation Report since 1994. And I just want to remind people of the reason why OTRU is tasked with this function. We are an arm's length, university-based, independent research evaluation and knowledge exchange unit. And we are able to provide to the partners in the tobacco control strategy across the province credible, independent data analyzed by top-level analysts and then interpreted by a PI, principal investigator group of eight people from three institutions of higher learning. We feel this is tremendously important to inform the work of people moving forward and to maintain people's understanding of what is working well in the different components of the strategy and what may need some improvement. Wanted to start by talking a little bit about some of the key findings, and those will be reiterated during the course of the report. The good news is that we are seeing major reductions in the prevalence of smoking amongst youth who are in school. We're down to prevalence rates of between 6% and 7% for kids who are in grade 12, and that is very encouraging. On the other hand, the rates of smoking for young adults, the 20 to 24-year-old group, for example, is at 25%. So we have a huge jump and need for focus of attention in that area. The less good news is that we still have not moved the adult prevalence of rates hardly at all in the past 5 years. There's no significant change in the rates of smoking in the past few years, and that is an issue of concern. Related to that, we're not seeing any progress at the population level in intentions to quit, in quit attempts, and in the overall quit rates. In the areas of protection, people continue to be exposed in some places. On the other hand, we are delighted to see some progress in passing of bylaws and policies in some municipalities in Ontario about outdoor smoking in different places. Those are some of the highlights. They will be reiterated as we move forward. The table of contents is in front of you, and you're welcome to look at the full report as we talk about different areas and delve into more depth. We're only going to give you the highlights today. The way that we work in our evaluation of the strategy, as in all of the evaluation that we do, is in this way. The purpose of evaluation is learning, it's learning, it's learning. Okay, it is not accountability that is not related to learning. Accountability and learning are tied to one another, and if you're not learning from evaluation, in my humble opinion, it's not worth doing. So we look at what is working, what can be improved, what is missing, and then we give some ideas based not from our sitting in the ivory tower and thinking amongst ourselves, but based on scientific evidence about how to go about making improvements. The conceptual approach to our strategy evaluation report is that the strategy, the tobacco control strategy, is a complex strategy. What does complex mean? Well, it means a couple of things. It means that it has many working parts, but it also means that those working parts interact together in ways that create non-linear results. So it means that by putting in X amount of effort doesn't mean if you put 2X amount of effort, you're going to get 2 times the results, because there are interactions and feedback loops and jump points that make it difficult to understand how it is that we are achieving the results that we're looking for, or maybe not achieving quite the full results that we're looking to. It is challenging to evaluate a complex strategy. In our report, we have developed new innovative approaches to doing this using a intervention path contribution analysis approach that brings us closer than we have been before to trying to telling a story that helps to marry what we see at the population level with the interventions that are happening at the more micro level. We are not new, as I said, to providing evaluation of the strategy. Since 1994, we've been around and doing this kind of work. We were heavily involved in, and Sean O'Connor, who's going to be speaking soon, in particular in the NAGMI effort, that was the National Advisory Group on Monitoring and Evaluation, developing the key population level indicators that we still use today. In 2005, we were heavily involved in developing a major report, the steering committee's report to the Ministry of Health. And then more familiar to you is the guidance documents that that are associated with the Ontario Public Health Standards, and that actually require local public health units to have comprehensive tobacco control strategies at that level, are heavily informed by previous monitoring and evaluation reports that we have conducted. Our evaluation is guided by these pathologic models. You're not supposed to be able to read what's in the slide in front of you. On the next slide, we give you a closer look that demonstrates the general sense of what is in those pathologic models. It starts with inputs. Goes through strategic components, or what I sometimes like to call the infrastructure. That would be things like PTCC, the training program, the TEACH program, the Ontario Tobacco Research Unit, all of those things that provide the support for you to be able to do your work in the field. Then we look at the strategic components that include all of the policy, program, and project level interventions, to various paths to achieving our longer-term outcomes. And one of the key paths, I'll just mention by way of illustration, is changing the social acceptability of tobacco use. And for the first time in our report, we're going to talk about some new data that we have about the social acceptability of using tobacco. Then we go to our short, medium, and long-term outcomes. In interpreting the data that we present, we are informed by what's in the guidance documents, and then in particular by two milestone documents that should be we think, at the center of all strategy planning and indeed policy and program planning as we move forward in the strategy. A couple of years ago, the Ministry of Health Promotion and Sport at the time invested, I think very wisely, in a scientific advisory committee that was composed of leading experts in the field in Ontario, and was reviewed and actually approved by leading experts from around the world, particularly the United States. So the report that we call Evidence to Guide Action, Comprehensive Tobacco Control in Ontario, should be the roadmap for the strategy moving forward. And we use it as our point for comparison of what exists today in the strategy, what the gaps are, and what's needed to help move those measures forward that I talked to earlier on that we're not quite doing as well as we would like to be doing on. The TSAG, or Tobacco Strategy Advisory Group report, called Building on Our Gains, builds on the SAC report and other input from stakeholders, and lays forth a more detailed sort of pathways to achieving the strategy goals over the course of a five-year period of time. Very quickly, I don't want to spend too much time on our methodology. The population level data is informed by those five surveys that you see in front of you. We analyze those data by various components, including population, gender, socioeconomic status, etc. And the report is about not only giving you a snapshot of what exists in 2012, but looking at trends over the course of time to see how well we're doing relative to previous times. So we don't stop at the population level. We look at all of the evaluative information that is available from the work that we do, the work that you do, the work that contracted evaluators do, and we use that to learn about the reach and the effectiveness of the various interventions. Then we do what we call a contribution analysis, which is to try, by talking with key players in the field, to get an understanding of the contribution of each of those interventions to the overall population level outcomes. We're going to stop right there, and the rest of the presentation is going to get into the meat and potatoes of the results and the conclusions that we draw about where we are so far. But are there any questions at this point about our approach and about the rationale for doing the strategy evaluation report to start off with?
And these would have to be typed in, I believe. So.
Yeah, okay.
You need to use the chat box if you have a question.
That's fine. Not seeing any, I think we can just move forward. And we're going to start by describing today's problem. So it is quite shocking to me every time I see the statistic. More than a fifth of us are still using tobacco in one form or another. So I don't think we need to convince the people on the line that tobacco is far from being finished. We're going to have a few polling questions. This gives you a chance to wake up and exercise your minds and imaginations. And this is the first of, I think, six polls that we have. So as we're loading the poll, you will now have a chance to vote just by clicking in the appropriate box. The question is, which tobacco product has the highest use, the highest past 30-day use? You have choices of cigar, chew, snooze, snuff, e-cigarettes, pipe, water pipe, and that's it. And I see lots of results coming in here.
Maybe we'll just leave it for a few more seconds.
Well, you've got to vote quickly.
No.
All right, so can we close the poll then now? So just to let you know, we had 75 responses, which is pretty good in a matter of about 10, 15 seconds, I think. And I find this technology pretty cool. What we have is 35%. Do they see the results of these polls? Okay, so you can see in front of you, the largest proportion of respondents think that chew, snooze, and snuff makes up the largest proportion of past 30-day use, followed fairly closely by cigar. 25% thought that e-cigarettes had the highest proportion, and about 9% water pipe. Well, the answers are...
Just bear with us a minute here as we advance the slides. One more.
There we go. The answer is, of course, this is cigarettes aren't included here, but the largest proportion of non-cigarette tobacco is actually cigars, which includes little cigars or cigarillos, and all of the others are down very low. Note that we don't really know e-cigarettes. We don't have a good measure of the prevalence of e-cigarettes. There's a lot of anecdotal information, and we have some evidence from a study done in the Eastern Tekan region saying that they're available in 19% of the vendor shops. So this is something we're going to be looking at more closely over the coming years, to give you more information. I wish we could have some discussion now to see how you feel about these relative to what you said, but we're limited by time and technology. Just to note another quick fact that probably you all know, that males are much higher users of tobacco than females, but the numbers are quite staggering. 29% of males versus 16% of females have used some form of tobacco in the past 30 days. Whoops. Sorry. Something's changed here, and now we advance.
Again, we're just trying to advance the slides. Bear with us. There we go.
Okay, thank you. Now we're going to, the rest of the presentation when we talk about numbers is all going to be about cigarettes. but we did want to draw to your attention that all tobacco use is at 22%, whereas past 30-day cigarette use is 18%. So that's a substantial difference and something we need to pay attention to. The numbers from CCHS for 2009-10 are that 18% of adults in Ontario are current smokers. That means they've smoked in the past 30 days, and that's as opposed to 15.5% in British Columbia, which is currently the lowest smoking jurisdiction in Ontario. As I mentioned earlier on, unfortunately, we do not see major reductions in the prevalence of adult smoking in the past few years. So you can see from the slide that from 2005 through 2010, it ranges from 20% to 18%. That there is actually, if you look at the confidence intervals, no significant statistical difference between those amongst those numbers. In the previous 5-year period, 2000 to 2005, there was a significant, statistically significant reduction, but not tremendous. It was from 23 to 20%. So just remembering, we're going to get to this in the next slide, that the TSAG report, the Tobacco Strategy Advisory Group, recommended that Ontario decrease the prevalence of smoking by 5 percentage points over a course of 5 years. Well, we've gone down, arguably maybe 1.5% in the past 5 years, and that's not statistically significant. And in the previous 5 years, we went down only 3%. Meaning there's a lot more work that needs to be done to reach that goal. Now, that is not an official Government of Ontario goal. The official Government of Ontario goal right now is to become the lowest smoking jurisdiction in the country. So that means we would have to overcome British Columbia, which is now at 2.5 percentage points is less than Ontario. But just to remember, British Columbia isn't likely to sit still. So assuming that British Columbia goes down at the same rate that Ontario goes down or has been going down, we've got to really start moving a lot faster. Obviously, the only ways to make progress are by both increasing the number of current smokers who quit and by decreasing the number of young people who initiate. And I say young people because there are almost no people over the age of 22. It's like 95% of initiation happens before 20. So there are almost no older people. So we've got to get the younger people not to start. If we wanted to decrease smoking prevalence by 5 percentage points in 5 years, that would be 490,000 smokers. Just to say that today we are at about 21,000 smokers that are actually quitting in the course of a year, based on the 1%. We've done a lot of calculations to see what it would take to get to that. So if uptake remained, if initiation remained the same, we would have to increase cessation rates by 2.4-fold. If uptake goes to zero, so there's no more initiation rate, and we don't change the cessation rate, then we cannot reach the 5 percentage point over 5-year goals. If we cut uptake in half, we still need to more than double the quit rate. Stop there for some questions if there are any.
And again, use your chat boxes to ask any questions, please. Just wait a few seconds maybe and see if anyone has any questions.
Okay, so I see that there have been a couple of comments about people buying e-cigarettes as cessation aids, which is really interesting. We had a recent discussion about that. So there's a lot of interest here, it seems, in e-cigarettes, and we agree it's an area in need of some monitoring and research and something that we would like to get working on over the next year.
Okay, then if there are no questions, maybe we'll just move on in the presentation.
Okay. And I'm going to do one last piece of presentation and then give you a rest for my raspy voice, nasal voice today, and pass it on to Sean O'Connor. Talk a little bit about cessation. And this is what our cessation system currently looks like. This is, you know, a really high-level picture of it. In the middle, we have our goal to increase successful quitting. We have our infrastructure, our capacity building programs, which are quite impressive between TEACH, PTCC, and the RNAO. And we have our policy interventions, which I need to remind people time and again are the most effective ways to get people to stop smoking. Is to raise the taxes, to make the stuff less available, to increase the places where you can't smoke, and the like. There has been, and in the report you'll see, there has been a lot of progress over the past year in increasing the reach of cessation services to the Ontario population. We've seen the number of people who are being reached by programs such as Smokers Helpline, Driven to Quit, Leave the Pack Behind, the Ottawa Heart Model, and Stop. We've seen quite substantial increases in the numbers of people being reached. That is really wonderful to see, and we know, and hopefully you know, that the ministry has additional ventures underway being rolled out and some new demonstration projects. That's tremendous, and we need much more of that to get us to where we need to be. Remembering that we also have negative vectors working at the same time, that we have the pro-tobacco influences. Included in that are the widespread availability of not only contraband cigarettes, but also discount cigarettes. So our most effective policy measure of taxation is having the feet wiped out from under it to a large extent by the fact that people can actually purchase cigarettes at a lower cost than they could 5 years ago. And if you look at it as a proportion of income, it looks even worse than that. As I said earlier, we have not really moved the yardsticks on some of the key cessation indicators. How many Ontarians have quit attention? So, you know, the good news is that a lot, 56% of Ontarian smokers intend to quit in the next 6 months. Well, gosh, if we could capitalize on that, we could reach those 490,000 smokers. And 25% in the next month. So, you know, that's indicating a serious quit intention. The 490,000 is less than 25%. So if we capitalize on a good proportion of those 25%, we would be in great shape. The bad news is that there hasn't been any significant increase in any of these, in either of these cessation indicators. The next indicator is how many have made one or more past year quit attempts. And again, you know, it's quite amazing. 40% of smokers have made a quit attempt in the past year. Well, if they're making a quit attempt, they sure as hell want to quit. Excuse the language. But unfortunately, they're not capitalizing on those quit attempts. So more needs to be done. We need to capitalize on those. And, you know, the problem is partially and to a large extent one of relapse. And, you know, one of the recommendations of the Scientific Advisory Committee was to engage smokers in the long term. Our interventions at this point almost exclusively engage smokers for a short period of time. They make a quit attempt. They maybe stay quit for a couple of days, a week. Most of them don't make it to a month. And then by the end of the year, we're at least 79% have relapsed. So there needs to be more attention to that. As I said before, our annual quit rate, adjusted quit rate, this is the proportion of smokers who actually succeeded in quitting for at least 30 days in the past year, is at 1.3%, which is much lower. The 6.4% that you see in the middle column, it doesn't take into account relapse. When we take relapse into account, we're down to 1.3% of smokers making a successful quit attempt in the past year. 1.3% of our 2.1 million smokers is much, much less than the over 400,000 that we need to get to. And that brings us to our second polling question.
Remember that you won't not be able to vote until the poll is open, so we're just now, Rob, maybe you can ask the question.
Yeah, the question is, which of the cessation services that we have had the greatest reach or had the most clients in the past year, 2011-12? And we have the Ottawa model, we have the ODB, that's the prescription medications for ODB, Ontario Drug Benefit clients, Smokers Helpline, the STOP program. STOP provides mainly, but not only, free NRT, nicotine replacement therapy, through different venues now, including family health teams, community health centers, and then there's the Quit and Get Fit contest. So which service had the most clients?
We'll just leave it open for a few seconds so we can get a few more responses.
Okay, we have 75 responses now, and this is what it looks like. As you see in front of us, the vast majority of respondents think that Smokers Helpline had the largest proportion of clients, and that's followed way, way down by the prescriptions for ODB patients. Then the Ottawa model and STOP were equal at about 13%. And the real answers are quite different than that. So we were also surprised when we got our first batch of data from the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care about the numbers of people who had received prescription medication as ODB clients. That is actually the service with the largest reach in Ontario. Surprise, surprise. It's this new service. It's only 1 year old approximately, and it already had 23,500 people there. Last time we looked, it was up to 35,000 people. So, and since then, we also know that pharmacists have now been given the ability to prescribe cessation drugs, not only for ODB patients, but for others as well. They're also offering counseling for ODB patients, and there were some 4,000 people over the last 12-month period who received counseling from pharmacists. So this is a newcomer to our cessation menu, and one that I think obviously people are less aware of and needs some attention given to it. And we now have one more polling question for cessation.
We're just opening up the lines now.
And this gives you a chance for some creative thinking, and we want to ask you to choose only one of these. So I know many of us are going to say, well, you've got to do all of these, but if you could do only one of these interventions, which is the one that you would choose, or which one would you say to your medical officer of health, your board of health, your minister of health, your premier, which one should you do? The possibilities are decrease the availability of tobacco, raise taxes, fund public education campaigns, train more health professionals, and increase support to prevent relapse. And
well, let's just give it a few seconds so more people can vote.
Some people are quick on the trigger, and others may have a few in the room that they need to reach agreement on, and that might be difficult, particularly in this polling question.
Okay, three or four more seconds, and then we're going to close the poll.
Okay, I see we have 82 responses right now, and going up to 85 responses, and the leader is decrease the availability of tobacco, and that's followed by raising taxes, and closely after thereafter increasing support to prevent relapse. So
I actually am delighted to see that people are really understanding that the most effective interventions for increasing cessation are the policy ones. Not to belittle the importance of programmatic interventions, the training, all that absolutely needs to be done and in a comprehensive approach. As we all know, we want to do all of it. And then we can just move to the next slide. And the next slide is going to ask us, what does the Scientific Advisory Committee, what did the Scientific Advisory Committee say we need to do in cessation? And the answer is very similar to the answers that were provided, that the participants just provided in the polling, saying that you really need to do the policy interventions, the taxation, the decreased availability. But there is also a very strong recommendation in the SAC report to fully develop the cessation support system. First, the ecological approach of getting people to the cessation system, including tailored media campaigns aimed at getting smokers to reach out to the cessation supports and to make them aware of the supports that are there, and then having a much more systematized and fully operational smoking cessation system. And we all, I hope you all know that, you know, it's really wonderful to see the Smoking Cessation Task Force and really strong support from the Ministry of Health and Long-Term Term Care Health Promotion Division to make that happen. So, you know, we're relatively optimistic for what's going to happen moving forward. We have a few questions now that we are going to start to address. The first question is it possible that we cannot meet the goal? I assume that that goal being 5 percentage points over 5 years, not only is that possible, it's more than likely. It's almost definite that that goal won't be reached. But, you know, the goals are somewhat aspirational. What I like about the goals is that they can be used to motivate different players to actually work and to do more. How do we capture what public health units are doing related to smoking cessation? Thank you for that question. We have not yet captured that in the strategy evaluation report. The Ministry of Health and Long-Term Care Health Promotion Division has been collecting some data about that. It wasn't available to us for the purposes of this report. We had started a process to do that in a systemized way on an annual basis. That apparently isn't going to be happening. Driven to quit challenge. We are aware that that is not happening next year. Can we clarify? Did you say youth smoking rates for grade 12 students are at 6 to 7%? Yes, that is correct. Why a smoking rate for 20 to 24 is at 20? Yet 9 of them smoking.
They can't see this.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've got a. Sorry about that. I thought you were seeing the questions I'm reading. The question is, smoking rates for 20 to 24-year-olds are 25%, and Sean's going to answer this question. Thank you.
Yeah. There's the next section is on prevention, so we'll get to some of these rates for youth and young adults smoking then. So we're just continuing with a few questions here.
So the next question is, you know, how do we actually then get to reaching the goals of the lowest smoking rate? When we're looking at the demographics of the smokers that we have in Ontario, do we need targeted intervention for priority populations? So I'm going to take the cop-out answer on that is yes, we need it all. Having only tailored programmatic interventions aimed at priority populations, I don't think would do the trick. When you look at the data about the numbers, not the proportions, but the numbers of smokers are greatest not in the priority populations. Right? So if you want to get the large numbers, you have to go, actually the largest number of smokers are white, male, Canadian-born, medium-level SES people. Right, so we need to keep that in mind when we're thinking of reaching large numbers of people and getting the rates done. for the purposes, for equity considerations, yes, absolutely, we need to target the priority populations. It all needs to be done. So I think that in the interest of time, we're going to move on to the next sections. Some questions we're not going to get to in the course of the discussion. We are committed to taking these questions back and getting back to you. I think we'll know where the questions came from so we can answer specifically, and maybe there's an opportunity just to share the questions and answers through the PTCC channel with all those who have been signed up on the webinar. Yes, right. I'm seeing nods here.
Yeah, that's a really good idea, Rob. So if we don't get to all the questions, there might be time at the end of the webinar as well. We'll try to answer them with each individual then as well. So let's move on then.
All right, so this is Sean speaking, and I'm going to be speaking on a couple of topics, but the next one being prevention. So if folks have questions on anything that we're presenting here, you don't have to wait to the end to type your questions. They can be typed in at any time, and then we may address them either then or at the end of the section. So here's a slide. There was an earlier question about smoking rates, and this is the Canadian Community Health Survey. The bottom of the bottom part of the slide, the scale is age groups, so 15 to 17 year olds, right up to 25 to 29 year olds, and this is showing the kind of rates of current smoking in the population of these ages. So we see amongst very young folk, it's 7%, moving up to 16%, and then we see this jump into young adulthood, going to 25 and 24%. So what I wanted to point out here is really, there is some progress in the young age groups, but it's kind of transitioning back into higher rates in young adulthood. This is kind of the similar same slide, but with kind of two periods of time, 2003 and 2010. So what this slide is demonstrating that, we have made progress with those younger groups, as I mentioned, right? It's down over 2003. But when we look at the older age groups, the rates are, fairly stable. They're both high and stable, which is a concern. This slide is a population of current smokers. And so amongst current smokers, how many engage in these other factors listed down the left-hand side of the screen? So, for instance, amongst current smokers, 81% have hazardous drinking.
They drink. Their behavior for drinking is hazardous.
Likewise, amongst current smokers, there's high drug use, high gambling, and so on down the screen.
We can see. I won't read each of these,
but this is just showing we're kind of segmenting the youth out. Who's at risk? The next slide is the same data, but we've thrown in the
non-smokers, right? So it's the green we
saw before in terms of the bars. But what
this slide is showing that relative to,
non-smokers,
current smokers engage in these other factors
much more, heavily than non-smokers. So this gets at, some populations that folks may want to consider targeting, and populations at risk for other chronic disease risk factors. Here's just an indicator in the report, and this goes true for cessation as well, and the subsequent section. There's lots of other material in the report that we're not mentioning. Obviously, it's 140 pages, so we're just doing some highlights. So I encourage people to look at the reports for more detail. This indicator is ease of obtaining cigarettes. We see that 9 in 10 smokers believe it's quite easy to get cigarettes. And if you're a non-smoker, half of non-smokers believe that it's quite easy to get cigarettes. So this is a good marker of how the kids themselves are feeling about this. And this would be students in grades 7 to 12. Going to kind of the system side, again, this is kind of just a capture of what was, in place in 2011-12. The report has this material in a logic model and does describe each of these areas in turn. There's a number of programs and services for prevention. number of policies that have been implemented that impact on prevention goals. Here's a selection of some of the actual programs, and of course at the bottom there, there's social context and pro-tobacco influences, which are kind of the negative vectors against all these positive public health initiatives.
So we now have another poll. Just waiting to open the line for the poll. And Sean, do you want to read the question?
Sure. So much like the very first poll question for cessation, this one is getting at what's next for prevention. So just give me a quick second here. So the poll is, what should we do next? Number one, decrease availability of tobacco. Two is raise taxes. Three, oh, we're going to grab the right poll here. My apologies. This is right, yeah. Yeah, number three, fund public education campaigns. Number four, enhance school-based education. Number five, focus efforts on transitions out of high school. So this is related to the slides we've shown about the uptake of smoking. Number six, increase youth engagement activities. So the poll is live now. We're waiting for a few more respondents to answer. Some of the groups that have, some of the calls that have a large number of people in the room, you have to do your own polls, I guess, and do the consensus of the room.
So we're getting up there. We're at 75 now. Just a few more. Can you put your polls through, your answers?
What's interesting is that decreased availability was quite high. It was the highest for cessation. We are seeing a little bit of difference between some of these initiatives versus the cessation, but there is some commonality as well. So going up to 80 people responding, we'll close the poll. Again, the overwhelming one is decrease availability. Focus efforts on transitions out of high school is quite polling, significantly less, but at 14%, and then raising taxes at 12%. Increased youth engagement, we can see here the next one. So we're going to
It's closed.
Yeah, the poll is closed now, so we're going to switch to, what SAC has recommended. And for those that aren't familiar with Scientific Advisory Committee's report, I'd encourage you to look at the report. But, they mention a number of these initiatives. They go on to talk about the importance of media and social marketing to kind of lay the foundation for a lot of the other initiatives that tobacco control can work with respect to youth and prevention. They go on to mention smoking in movies and the need for rating systems and warning youth about smoking in movies. In particular, they talk about the need for in-school and community-wide programs for everybody. And they make a specific reference to the fact that beyond targeting the general population of youth, that high-risk schools are particularly important, that you can get a lot of bang for your buck by looking at schools that have high smoking prevalences and or communities that have demographics that like low income and so forth that are factors associated with smoking and initiation. Again, that report mentions a number of other initiatives, so I'd encourage folks to look at that report. So perhaps before we move on to prevention or rather protection, we're just going to answer a few questions here. So just give me a moment to read the question, and I will.
And again, remember to use your chat box if you'd like to ask a question.
So one question is, do you know who the ministry consulted with before setting the lowest smoking rate goal? And the lowest smoking rate goal. So that I guess, could be in relation to the lowest smoking rate in Canada. And I'm not exactly sure who
they didn't. They didn't consult with us. I don't know. But that goal appears in Ontario's plan for action on health, and it appears in the current budget. So this has been a decision that's been made.
Also note, in writing, there is no time frame set on that goal. It just says to become the lowest smoking rate in Canada. However, at a recent meeting of one of the task forces, ministry representatives indicated that that was to be done within a five-year time frame. So that isn't apparently official government policy, but that does seem to be the guidance that the civil servants are using at this point in time.
We have one question here. It states, if we are to reduce the prevalence and policy is the best approach, how do we meet the goal within the current apparent freeze on the government's desire to entertain policy change? So a couple of responses, I guess. Local level governments are able to implement, you know, a limited set of policies. So that's from a policy point of view, that can be done. And with respect to availability, I know a number of jurisdictions in the province are beginning to look at availability in terms of vendor licenses and so forth. So there's a whole kind of stream of policy options around availability, and it may well be others, even in terms of protection, that will have, you know, implications for prevention. As Rob, just kind of going back, the question also talked about reaching the goal. Going back to kind of some of the beginning slides, if we're going to reach the goal of the kind of the lowest rate of smoking in Canada, we talked about cessation and the need to increase cessation efforts. The other component of that is to decrease initiation. So, you know, the things that can be done to decrease initiation are obviously going to be important to meet that goal as well.
So there are a couple of questions.
Sure.
About initiation and the difference between initiation and prevalence. And going back up to what is on our page, the fourth question, Robin's question, to clarify. So, at the end of grade 12, 6 to 7% of kids who are in school. So there's some kids who aren't in school who are not being captured by those data, because our surveys, the YSS and the OSSA survey, are only given to kids who are in school. So the actual rate of smoking among kids of that age group may be higher than 6 to 7% is right. One thing.
So the 15 to 17 data we presented was CCHS, so that is a general population survey. So
okay.
We present a couple of some data from OSDA and some data from CCHS.
Right. And then on a previous slide, it's true that 20 to 24 year olds are at 25%, but then 16 to 20 are at somewhere around 19%, I think, already. So the jump is happening before the age of 20 to a large extent, okay, but after kids are leaving high school.
Right.
That's when it happens, before they get to be 21 to 24 years old.
Yeah. So I'll refer people to the report as well. In the report, we have a number of we present a number of charts on different indicators around the uptake of smoking. So, for instance, you know, we have abstinence rates by grade, and you know, in grade 7, abstinence is 97%. That is never having smoked a whole cigarette. So, you know, virtually no one in grade 7, has ever tried smoking a cigarette. By the time you get to grade 12, it goes up to 65% of lifetime abstinence. So we see that there, you know, people are. Or, you know, by the time they're grade 12, they've initiated in the sense of experimentation. We do know from the literature that, you know, approximately, you know, over 70, you know, 71% of youth that initiate, that is, that experiment with smoking, they'll go on to become smokers. So, you know, the goal of abstinence is quite relevant if we want to reduce youth smoking, given the large numbers that will go on to eventually become smokers. The report also mentions, you know, kind of past year smoking as well, who's initiated over the past year. So from the report, you can start to get a profile of this initiation to experimentation right through to current smoking. And we see there's some transitions, you know, kind of getting into high school around grade 9, that whereas grade 7 and 8, no one's smoking, in grade 9 thereabouts, in grade 10, if you look over the past year, which then they would have been in grade 9, they're starting to initiate. And then, as Rob mentioned, going out of high school, there's this jump from kind of 12 to kind of young adulthood, where the rates go way up in terms of current smoking, so there's some transitionings happening there as well. So, yeah, so this is just kind of the discussion, just responding to some of the question here. We're going to be moving on to protection next.
Right, and we'll come back to questions if we have time at the end of the session, too. So don't worry, we are keeping track of these questions. I think now we have another polling.
So there's a question here about whether the correlated risk factors are correlated also with whether or not parents smoke. We haven't done that analysis. It's known generally that the likelihood of a kid smoking is much greater if the parents smoke, but we haven't looked at that in particular against the drinking, gambling, drug use, et cetera.
That's right, and I think the recent U.S. Surgeon General does speak to this. The Surgeon General's report, so it's an authoritative source of a review of the evidence on youth prevention and uptake and so forth, so I think they do talk about that. So we're going to move on to the protection goal in select findings from the report. We're going to start off with a poll on protection, and I can read the poll. So in which settings are Ontarians most exposed to secondhand smoke? So, you know, which of these settings has the highest rate of exposure in terms of the population being exposed? Restaurants and bars, indoors, number one. Number two is outdoor patios, up restaurants and bars. Number three, indoor workplaces. Number four is home. Five is multi-unit dwellings. And number six is vehicles.
So we'll just leave the line open for about 5 or 6 seconds for everyone to put in their responses. Okay, that's probably good to close the poll now.
All right. So yeah, this is quite interesting. We see folks, you know, think there's little or no exposure in restaurants and bars, indoor workplaces, and in vehicles. And those are the three areas that are currently under provincial regulation. So one would hope that exposure would be zero in those settings, given that they're regulated. We see multi-unit dwellings is extraordinarily high at 68, close to 70%. 7 in 10 folks believe that to be the case. And folks can see the other settings there. So let's just jump to the next slide, which gives a little bit of data on some exposures. A couple of caveats about this slide that's coming up in a moment. Some of the data that will be presented are from different sources. So they asked the question slightly differently, so it's not 100% fair to compare these. I can say that the restaurant, bar, and outdoor exposure is all from the same survey. It's past month exposure. So we see people had it right, 3% restaurant bars is very little exposure. Lots of exposure in outdoor patios, though. Indoor workplaces, this is exposure in the past week for five or more minutes. Folks had indicated zero here, I believe, so there's quite a bit of exposure indoors in the workplace. We obviously need to do a better job of surveillance here it mostly comes from we need better instruments to figure out what's happening here in indoor workplaces. It's quite high given that it is a regulated place. 5% in home and vehicles, this is past month exposure every day or almost every day. MUDS it's not zero. We don't have any surveillance information on MUDS. We don't have any questions on the major population surveys that we use. I would not expect that it would be 70%. I would expect it to be significantly lower than that.
70% of the respondents said
it's
the
most. The highest. Yeah, that's true. We don't have surveillance information on that. Obviously, the proportion of the population that live in MUDS in Ontario. Might inform that, but we hope to get data on that in the future. So with that, let's move on. So, you know, again, the report discusses a number of settings about exposure to secondhand smoke, so I refer people to that. But, you know, there is some good news for protection. The government has spent a lot of effort over the last 15, 20 years, as has the tobacco control community. We do see, as I mentioned, workplaces is quite high, so that merits some attention. And patios is quite high. That is something that a number of public health units have sought to address by implementing their own policies, and something that we that the report does discuss in length. There is a chapter on public opinion. There is a quite high support for public opinion for restrictions in these various settings. So with that, I think we can maybe entertain some questions. So by indoor exposure, would that be someone who may be exposed in office or workplaces by those smoking by entrances or air intakes over actual smoking inside? The question is, you know, we don't have an answer. You know, the survey questions are not that specific. So the survey questions do ask about indoor exposure. It is possible that someone, that a worker may define that by saying, you know, as I enter the building, I'm getting exposed. We need more nuanced survey questions for that. So,
and during the field.
Yeah, and we are seeking to get those questions, and hopefully in 2014 we will have those. There's usually a year or so lag to get data. All right. In terms of what the SAC report has recommended, they again have made a number of recommendations on protection. So I do refer people to that report for a detailed summary of their recommendations. But generally speaking, some of the recommendations that they make are the need for continued enforcement to enforce existing laws. They talk about the need for media interventions to raise not only kind of the awareness, public awareness of the policies, but also just to raise, to change the social climate around the population's acceptance of exposure to secondhand smoke. Given that we're running a little short on time, I'm going to be moving on. There is a question here, does indoor exposure include enclosed workplaces such as vehicles? I believe it does. Yeah. And I think over the years we have asked some specific questions on exposure in vehicles in the workplace. I would refer to people to the Tobacco Informatics Monitoring System that may have specific information on that. And we can follow up specifically on that question as well. Okay. All right, so the strategy evaluation report, a couple new chapters this year. There is a chapter on social climate and public opinion, which I alluded to, and there's a chapter on tobacco or pro-tobacco influences. So with respect to some information that we have in that social climate chapter, here's a couple of findings. So we've asked, on population surveys, we've asked adults 18 years and over how acceptable it is for adults to smoke. And 44% of respondents said it's acceptable for adults to smoke versus 9% for teenagers. So we do see that difference, and it's perhaps not surprising that the acceptability of teenagers smoking is quite a bit lower. With respect to the population's view on the acceptability of smoking indoors at social gatherings, 14% of people responded that it's acceptable. Of course, the corollary of that is that the majority of people find that it's not acceptable to smoke indoors. Moving on to outdoor social gatherings, we see close to 6 in 10 adults find that it is acceptable to smoke outdoors at social gatherings. So there's still, and this suggests some, our previous question said what can be done. The mass media and other public health initiatives can work to change the acceptability of smoking to try to influence, these types of indicators.
So I believe we now have another polling question. Do you want to read that question, Sean?
Yes. So this speaks to some of the questions we've asked about public support around policies. So we've got a question here. What policy has the highest level of support among smokers? So again, we've surveyed smokers and asked them which of these policies do they agree with, or they're in support, rather. in agreement with. So we've got these four or five. I won't read them. I see we've got 20-odd responses now. Actually, I might read them in, just in case some folks can't see this poll. So what policy has the highest level of support among smokers? We see governments should sue big tobacco. Number two, sell cigarettes in plain white packs. Number three is phase cigarettes out in 5 to 10 years. And number four is reduce the number of retail outlets that sell tobacco.
So we'll just leave that open for a few more seconds here.
So we see that in Ontario, that the first initiative is currently part of a government policy in terms of the lawsuits towards the industry. Sell cigarettes in plain white packs, that's a policy that's talked about by a number in the tobacco control community. We've just gone to 75% health warning on packs. Some jurisdictions in the world have gone to plain packs. This is a legacy question. We probably would not prefer white packs. We'd prefer a different color, but given that we've asked this question for about 10 or 15 years, we don't want to give up on it. And what we're going to do next is we're going to actually go to the actual results of the population surveys. Just give us a moment here as we navigate away from the poll towards the data. So again, this is attitudes amongst smokers. So interestingly, the highest one here is that most smokers agree that that cigarettes should be sold in plain packs, plain white packs. At half of all smokers believe this, and the report does go on and does, you know, it does present the information on the general population and non-smokers as well as former smokers. But this is quite significant if you think of these, that these are actually smokers being asked this question. 31 or 3 in 10 smokers think that cigarettes should be phased out in 5 or 10 years. 3 in 10 smokers believe that reduced outlets, or that in terms of the number of outlets that sell cigarettes should be reduced. So arguably some of this, you know, the smoking population might even be ahead of some decision makers around policy. There's a huge support with some of these policies for the general population. And amongst even the population of smokers, significant support for these policy measures. So I don't think we should discount some of these measures that some people may think, well, that's kind of way out there. They're not. I mean, they're even accepted by a large number of smokers. Pro-tobacco influences. I'm just going to pause here for a split second to make sure there's no questions. I don't see any questions at this point on social climate or public opinion. Again, I will mention that the chapter is 15, 20 pages long and has a number of indicators around public support and social climate that I will refer people to. It's usually quite well received, and people can find uses for that information in their day-to-day work. So a new chapter this year is pro-tobacco influences. And by pro-tobacco influences, it may be tobacco companies, but it may be others as well in terms of front groups, retail communities that sell cigarettes, and a whole host of other influences that seek to kind of increase the use of tobacco in society. So a couple of examples. Maybe just before I jump to an example, we're only going to talk about some product modifications and some new packaging that has been introduced in the province over the last year. But the chapter itself does get into a number of indicators, approximately 16 odd indicators, going right through from agricultural indicators to production to, as I mentioned, product innovations, smoke-free, smoking in the movies, and so forth. So again, I refer people to the chapter for more information. Of course, pro-tobacco influence is part of the logic models. It's in the logic models presented in the guidance documents. It's been part of the strategy logic models for the last 10, 15 years. So with a couple of examples of pro-tobacco influences, as folks may well be aware, little cigarillos were been growing in popularity several years ago. The flavored cigarillos were prohibited. What we see here on the left-hand side is a old package or an old ad copy of a package of little cigarillos. Those were subsequently prohibited in terms of flavors. So what the industry did is they raised the weight off the cigarillo. They changed, they modified the filter tip to come into legislation, and they have a new product, which are cigars, and they are almost identical. They can even still call them little cigarillos if they want. As we've shown in the report, the prevalence, although the population prevalence of cigars and little cigarillos may be quite low at around 5%, if you look at youth and young adults' use of little cigars and cigarillos, it is quite high. And in terms of the legislation, although flavors were prohibited, we see here that flavors are well entrenched in the marketplace. Another example from this chapter is new packaging. So here's two new packages from JTI. The one on the left significant for the fact that it's really marketed. It's a budget brand. So these super slim purse packs, which kind of look like lipstick or perfume, are usually premium cigarettes, $10-$11 a pack. They've introduced a budget brand. Although the warning does come down to 75% of the principal surface area, given the dimensions of the pack, we see the side of the pack, which is almost as big as the front of the pack, is not legislated. But by having almost a square pack, they can brand the two sides and still get away with a significant amount of promotion of their product. The package on the left, again, just the same type of thing. This is a luxury product. We do see these super slim packs frequently marketed towards youth, females, and so forth, given their kind of connotations of lipstick packs and so forth. So just a flavor of what's in that chapter. Again, there's 16 odd indicators on pro-tobacco influences. And we'll just check our questions here to see if we have any questions. So in the presentation at the very end, we do have a link to the PDF of the report. And if folks are getting the slides, that will be available in the slides. If people go to the OTRU website, otru.org, it is on the homepage of the web. There's a link on the homepage to the report as well. So with that, I'm going to pass the final slide or two to Dr. Rob Schwartz.
Thanks, Sean. So this is our last slide, and I just want to reiterate some of the key messages about where we're at. So the conclusion is, it is a bit of a puzzle. Ontario is an innovator, it's a pioneer, and has actually implemented most of the policies that are recommended by the FCTC, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. The Empower measures are six of the main policies. So we haven't done them all. We haven't done them all completely. Clearly, even though we've done a lot, we're not making progress. That is the puzzle. The conclusion is that we need to redouble our cessation efforts to produce the gains that are needed. The reach is 75,000 smokers with the current project, and that's an increase over the previous year. But we need to reach a lot more smokers, and we've got to keep them from relapsing by engaging them over the long term to make a bigger dent in this puzzle. We're very happy to see the downward trend for youth, and we think, if this is true and they don't actually pick up between leaving high school and the age of 20, 21, then we may see that this is going to affect the prevalence in very positive ways in the future. We don't yet know what the cohort effect of this is. It's something we have to keep on looking at very closely. I was really interested in the response about where are people most exposed to secondhand smoke, and that people thought MUDs. Clearly, work needs to be done on MUDs. I've said this in some forums. I am a victim of exposure to secondhand smoke in MUDs, And I am really upset about this personally and for the province of Ontario for many people. It's a huge problem, and I hope that it can get a lot more attention. The social climate questions that we put in for the first time this year, from questions on the CAMH monitor, demonstrate that almost half of people still think that it's socially acceptable for adults to smoke. In order for there to be less smoking and for more people to quit, that has to change. It has to become less socially acceptable. So that is a challenge to all health promoters. How do you bring about a change in the social acceptability of smoking? How do you get it down? The fact that over half of the people say that it's socially acceptable to smoke in outdoor celebrations. Well, I don't want to go to a celebration that's outdoor and have people smoking. That in and of itself is something that increases the social acceptability of smoking. So there's room that needs to be done there, and we cannot forget that the tobacco industry is not gone to sleep. It hasn't given up on selling and profiting from tobacco in Ontario, and we've got to keep on doing the things that we're doing. So overall, prevalence not changed in a major way. Good point, youth prevalence is down. Bad point, there's a huge jump from youth to young adulthood. Cessation, we really need to do a lot more. And there have been some questions here about, well, in a situation when the province is not in a situation where it's supporting new policies, what do we do? Well, I want to answer that one from my public policy background. My PhD is actually in public policy and administration. The courses I teach in public health policy, tell us that, well, if one venue, i.e. the provincial government, is closed for business right now, or is at least perceived to be closed for business right now, put our efforts into other venues. And, so, for example, people, some public health units and some municipalities are working hard to get outdoor exposure, outdoor secondhand smoke exposure decreased by regulation in those areas. I mean, that's a great example. I was also really interested to see the answers about people saying on two of the polls that what you need to work on is decreasing availability of tobacco. And we really agree with that. I know, true, we have a couple of research projects going on demonstrating the importance of working on availability. But when we go out to the public health units, when we do the regional action planning, we have seen very little appetite for actually work to be done to decrease the availability, for zoning bylaws, for disallowing the sale of tobacco close to schools, for even health promotion work to get vendors to stop selling this stuff. Even though public support, as we demonstrated, for decreasing the availability of tobacco is really high, even a third of smokers think that the sale of tobacco should be phased out within 5 years, 5 to 10 years. There is appetite for this. All right, I'm gonna stop here. I think we've covered quite a lot of ground. There are a few questions that are coming up. Sean, did you want to address any of those?
Sure, I can go through. There's one question here. Will you speak further on e-cigarettes and how it's impacting the general public as well as the youth population? So no, we're not speaking anymore on e-cigarettes. The report doesn't spend a lot of time on e-cigarettes, in part because there's very little or no surveillance data. I do want to, put a plug in for the Ontario Student Drug Use and Health Survey, which will be in the field this spring, and that report, or the data will become available next November of 2013. They do have a question on there. In the last 12 months, how often did you smoke, you see the specific wording I don't have in front of me, but in any respect, they will be asking, I think, a question on e-cigarettes on the Ontario Student Drug Use Survey, and we'll have that in November. In 2013, we are asking a number of questions on e-cigarettes and water pipe use, so that data for adults will be available in in 2014.
And I think there's room, I think there's a lot of appetite for more knowledge about e-cigarettes. We would love to do it, and if we're asked to do it by the partners, then I think there's a good chance we could get some good knowledge about that over the coming years. So that's an encouragement to you to have to ask us to do it. what magazine?
We got that, yeah. So we're just, the pauses are just us reading questions and preparing responses. One question here, the one statistic mentioned indicated that 85% of youth thought tobacco was easy to obtain. Is there a breakdown of tobacco vendors, contraband, or other social sources? So in terms of the indicator of ease of obtaining, there's no, that's it. There's nothing by sources. There are other indicators, you know, where did you get your cigarettes? With response categories like, you know, contraband sources, vendor sources, social sources, and I believe we may have an indicator in the report for that as well. Given the sample sizes of surveys, we can typically just talk about that youth got their cigarettes from a retail source or they got it from a social source without really breaking it much further than that.
Right, but we do have other data on contraband use amongst youth from YSS, and it is apparently quite high. Contraband data is iffy. We don't have really good data on it. It seems to vary. It may be seasonal. We'll look at that more. The question, there's a question here about are we focusing efforts on getting data about chew, tobacco, or smokeless in high school age youth? We have not been, but if that is perceived as a problem, as a need for new knowledge, I would again encourage you to ask us to do some work in that area. Certainly, from the population level data, it doesn't seem that chew is a big issue, but we do hear every year, you know, in some areas it seems to be, you know, related to sports sometimes, and in certain areas of the province it seems to be a larger issue than in others. We'd be happy to assist in collecting data in that area.
And if folks, I might mention, if folks are looking to collect data in that area, we're happy to consult with them on question wording. One thing we, over the years, we have found that if you ask youth, have you ever tried chew, it can be quite high, the prevalence. But if you ask them, yeah, but have you used it in the last 30 days, which is kind of like a current use of chew, it just falls almost to nothing, right? So people appear to maybe experiment with it, but they don't appear to be kind of an active, current, ongoing user of that substance. But again, anecdotal evidence suggests, you know, particularly in the north, I've heard that it is a problem, it is a concern, so I think we do need to continually monitor the use of chew and other forms of tobacco as well. Again, we're just giving us a moment here, we're just kind of triaging some questions here in our available time. I think we only have seconds, so yeah.
Yeah, so there's a question here about the role of legislation and enforcement on school property and what role that's played in decreasing the prevalence of smoking amongst school-aged youth and what ramifications that has for young adults. I think it's very different. You know, many people leave school who become smokers are not on campuses at all, and smoke-free campuses is something that has not been tremendously successful. But I think an interesting area for further exploration. Do you know if exposure in workplaces is related to the size of the workplace or sector?
So yeah, we don't have any information on that. It may be possible in the future to get exposure by sector, broad sector, because we can get that from population survey data. So for instance, are people white collar workers, blue collar workers, so forth? What's their exposure? And so that indicator is possible, but not too detailed information. Detailed information is not available on that indicator.
I see some other people are still typing, but we have run to almost the end of our time. I just want to thank you, Rob and Sean, for your time, and I want to encourage everyone to access that report that is on the screen right now, and feel free to contact PTC. Like more information about PTC services and resources, or if your health unit or organization would like to host a PTC training session. Also, I just want to remind everyone again that you will be receiving an email after this webinar, and that's going to have a link to an evaluation survey. If you could kindly take a few minutes to just review and complete that evaluation, it would be greatly appreciated. Your input will help us improve our webinars and host future learning opportunities to meet your needs. And for those of you who would like to access the webinar recording, that will also be made available to you, and details will be provided in a follow-up email. And finally, thank you all for joining our session today, and a special thank you to our two guest presenters for sharing with us a snapshot of their study results.
Thank you. Please stand by.